Way, the science edition of Press Conference USA. Here's your host, Rick Pantaleo.
Welcome to the science edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Computer systems related to several elements of the U.S. Democratic Party were attacked recently in a series of hacking incidents. To make matters worse for the political party, emails intercepted in the attack, which contained some embarrassing information, were made public by the website WikiLeaks just hours before the Democratic National Convention was to open in Philadelphia. Shortly after the incident became public, the DNC announced that two groups affiliated with Russian intelligence were responsible for penetrating their computer systems. This week, it was reported that a suite of powerful computer hacking tools developed by the U.S. National Security Agency mysteriously appeared on the Internet. Security experts say that this could possibly compromise the NSA's operations and put government and corporate computers and computer networks at risk. Others suggest that online posting of the hacking tools could also be a hoax. Today, we'll talk with cybersecurity experts and even a former hacker to learn more about cyber attacks and hacking. My first guest today is B. Clifford Newman, an expert in computer security, director of the University of Southern California Center for Computer Systems Security, senior project leader with the USC Information Sciences Institute, and an associate research professor of computer science. He joins us by telephone from Los Angeles. Professor Newman, let's start with a very basic question. How do you define hacking?
Well, you know, the term hacking is used to describe individuals that try to, in the process of breaking into systems, making changes in systems in perhaps an unauthorized manner. You go back to really the origin of it many, many years ago, and it was more sort of enthusiasts that were just trying to play with computer systems. And in some sense, it was sort of a good thing, even though they got into a little bit of mischief. But the term has really been usurped and used to include all kinds of criminal activity, system cracking, as it might better be called, where you've got a lot of different motivations. Nowadays, much of the motivations is either financial, criminal enterprises, terrorist, nation states, as well as, of course, the enthusiasts that are just trying to make a name for themselves and brag, sort of like tagging of things and graffiti. So you've got a range of motivations that are coming into play, but the end result of hacking or system cracking or security breaches is to violate the security policies of a system to make changes or to acquire information or to use resources that one is not authorized to do.
So I'm taking that along with trying to break into a computer system, hacking also involves creating viruses, malware, or conducting denial of services on websites?
Well, certainly the denial of services on websites is one of the forms of criminal activities that we've seen. We see that in the form of hacktivism, when you've got some social principle that the site is going against, or taking down a site simply because they're associated with some entity that one is opposed to. But you also see denial of service attacks as more criminal and extortion. So you've got a lot of small businesses where denial of service attacks are mounted against them, keeping them from conducting their business, and then a few hours after the attack, they'll get an email saying, "We've demonstrated we can do this unless you wire this amount of funds to us," or nowadays the big way is send us this number of bitcoins, we're going to continue the denial of service attack. And you've seen a lot more with ransomware. So the denial of service on websites is by overwhelming the sites with packets. But the ransomware is a virus or other malicious code that ends up installed on your system. Maybe you clicked on an executable or went to a website that has what's called a drive-by download, and your system starts running this software that will encrypt, scramble the data on the files that you have on your system. And then you've got the extortion demand that comes that says, unless you send us this many Bitcoin, we're going to hold your files ransom. If you pay the ransom, then some of the time you are sent a decryption key that allows you to get your data back. Some of the times you just out the bitcoins and you still don't get your files back.
Now, getting back to hacking itself, I understand there are three types of hackers. They're known by the color of the hats they wear: white hat, black hat, and even gray hat. What are they and what differentiates them from each other?
Well, when you hear the term white hat hacking, basically what they're doing is they're paid by companies to test the security of the company's own systems. So they're not doing anything illegal. They've got permission from the company to go in and try to find vulnerabilities in the systems and to report those to the companies. Sometimes there will be bug bounties, for example, where an organization will say, you know, try to find vulnerabilities in our software, report that to us, we'll give you a certain amount of money so that we can go and fix that. That's your white hat hacker. If you look at your black hats, those are the ones that apply the same techniques, but they're scanning systems that they don't have permissions to access. They're looking at acquiring data that they're then going to release, or they're going to use, if, let's say, it's credit card numbers, for fraudulent purposes. And then the gray hat's just sort of somewhere in between.
Can you give me a profile of a typical hacker, or is there such a thing?
Well, you've got a range of capabilities. So you've got those that have the real technical know-how, that are able to look at a piece of software, spend time analyzing it, looking for new kinds of vulnerabilities. These ones, they can either be black hat or white hat, but if they're black hat, what they typically do is when they find a vulnerability, they sell that vulnerability on these underground discussion forums to others that are then going to use that vulnerability to break into systems. If they were white hats, what they do is they report it to the company that's got the vulnerable system so that it can be fixed. Those are the ones that have more of that technical ability. Then you've got those that don't have a great deal of technical ability. They're referred to as script kiddies. Don't ask me why they're called this, except for the fact that the script is the program that they run or the set of procedures that they follow that's written down for them, where they're basically exploiting the vulnerabilities that others have found. They're not doing things that are original, except for the fact that they are applying these in order to find those existing vulnerabilities that others have found on the systems that they are trying to attack. Nowadays, when we start to see more organized crime involved in the system security breaching community, you've got perhaps people with a little bit more technical expertise that are still applying these scripts, but with a more targeted goal: to acquire credit card information, to acquire social security numbers, things that are going to be used elsewhere. And certainly we also have nation states that are involved, where they've got their whole arsenal of tools that have been acquired from known attacks or even unknown attacks, things that are called zero-day attacks, so that they are able to break into a larger number of systems, those that have a higher security profile in some sense.
So what kind of skills are necessary for someone to become a successful hacker?
Well, again, it looks at what you're doing. If you're the kind that's going to look for vulnerabilities in software and other things, you're going to need strong programming skills, sort of a cynical mind, a way of looking at things. If all that you're doing is applying the scripts and the programs that have been written by someone else to capture the low-hanging fruit, that is, those systems that are not particularly secure, it's the same kind of skills that one needs for social media or Facebook. That is, you go to these forums, you say, oh, here's something that I can purchase. You purchase that attack, you apply it against a system, and you see what you're able to find. So for those kinds of attackers, the skills are not as great as those that are really finding new things, the more researchy kind of attacks.
Now, when we're talking about hacking and hackers, do hackers often target individual computers and users, or do they cast their net sort of wider and go after targeting companies, governments, or large networks?
Well, it's a mixed. So if you look at a lot of the malware, the malicious code, the viruses, and the worms, those tend to be a very wide network. What you do is you try to get your software installed on as many systems as possible. The end consumer systems, their home machines, tend to be quite weak, so it's more likely you're going to be able to get into those systems. And that software might be things like the ransomware we talked about. So a home user or small business may get that ransomware demand. Another thing that a lot of end systems are infected with are what are called botnets, where once that malicious code is installed on their home system, that machine is under the control of the criminal from somewhere else. It'll still be doing what you think you want it to do, but in the background, it's being used for denial of service attacks. It's being used to set up fake websites for phishing scams where someone tries to steal passwords, for example. And the software can also be used to scan your disk looking for documents or credit cards or other kinds of things that are there. You then have those adversaries that are targeting specific companies, perhaps higher profile companies that have stronger security measures in place. Now, in this case, they're going to target a specific company. They're going to find the perhaps individuals within that company that have less of an awareness of security, and they're going to target them with either phishing or they're going to send them a CD through the postal mail that they might install in their system, or a thumb drive which is going to infect their system, and then they've got a foothold in the network that they're able to utilize to try to find things from within a company. And this gets us to sort of some of the kinds of targeted attacks that we've seen more recently. So we look at the attack on the DNC. That was a very targeted attack where, well, you know, for many years now, the FBI and the government's been saying that we've got a concerted effort and many successes at attacking political campaigns. And the reason that there are the attacks on the political campaigns is not so much to manipulate the elections, but because the individuals that are logging into those sites have access to other things within the government, or it could be information that's going to be useful if that party comes into power or that candidate takes office. So we've seen this kind of thing happening a lot. And these tend to be very targeted. You look for specific individuals, you target them, you try to get that foothold into the system. And the classic way of conducting a concerted breach involves first doing some reconnaissance, deciding who your targets are going to be, trying to get malware or credentials from those individuals, logging into the system, escalating privileges, but then you're in. That's not the end of it. You repeat the process because you use your footing within that system now to target other systems that might be deeper within the organization. Or, as we saw recently, you know, one might look at the breach of the DNC, and then you look at the breach of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee and the breach of the Hillary Clinton campaign systems, and you say, wait, why is someone only targeting the Democrats in this case? Well, in fact, it's not surprising because once they got the foot in the door to the Democratic National Committee systems, it happens to be the case that the same individuals are using that system as using each of these other systems. So that becomes the foot in the door, and now they've got access to or the ability to breach in or hack into the systems of individuals that are using these other systems. So that's why you might not see the same level of hacking at, let's say, you know, Republican campaigns. That's not to say that their systems are any more secure, but it's they got the foot in the door on the Democratic side. Now they're just pushing the door wider open. It wouldn't surprise me if we see similar kinds of hacks in non-Democratic campaigns because all systems are vulnerable. The main difference, I think, in some of these things might be the level of control that the organizations have of the employees or the workers in a particular campaign.
Professor Clifford Newman, thank you so much for sharing your insights about hacking today.
You're welcome.
B. Clifford Newman, an expert in computer security, director of the University of Southern California's Center for Computer System Security, senior project leader of the USC Information Science Institute, and an associate research professor of computer science. You're listening to the Science Edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I'm your host, Rick Pantaleo. I'd like to remind you that Press Conference USA is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA or send us an old-fashioned email to PCUSA@voanews.com. We'll be back with more of our program after this.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
We're back with the science edition of Press Conference USA. I'm Rick Pantaleo. Over the last couple of months, there have been several high-profile hacking attacks where data snatched in the attacks were made available to the public. With me now are Mark Dufresne and Andrew Morris. Both work for Endgame Incorporated, an Arlington, Virginia-based cybersecurity firm that helps businesses proactively go on offense and hunt for attackers on their networks. Mark, who joins me in studio, is the director of Endgame's Threat Research and Adversary Prevention. Andrew, who joins us by telephone from Florida, is a threat researcher at Endgame. He got his start in the cybersecurity field as a teenager working as a non-destructive or ethical hacker. Mark Dufresne, can you tell us where we are concerning our ability to pinpoint the origin of cyber or hacking attacks?
So there's a couple of problems to talk about. One is detecting the attack in the first place, which is a huge problem right now still for defenders of network attacks. And there's a whole set of new methodologies coming out to deal with that. Some things along the line of cyber threat hunting, which is all about finding things you don't know to be looking for. That can be a very difficult problem to solve. And in fact, we at Endgame don't really get into that business too much. We don't get into the attribution business, the who's behind the keyboard, the why are they doing it. You can do a few things to try to start answering some of those questions. You see malware on endpoints. You see what the attacker does on a computer once they land there. And you see how they're communicating in and out of the network. So what IP addresses that their communications are coming in from, what domain names that are being resolved. Like when you use your computer to go to Voice of America's website, you type in some letters and those get converted to an IP address by something called the domain name system. You can look at all those things to try to find out kind of some of the whodunit, like who registered that domain name. You know, you actually have to go through a process to register that so it will properly resolve. You can look at things like geographically, where is that IP address? You can look at of other known attacks by this group, is there any overlap between registration information, between geographically where it is, between what IP address, but all that's getting a lot harder because the attacker knows that they want to hide. They want to make attribution hard. So they're not reusing as many of these artifacts across operations. So that becomes very difficult. You might find them using totally new domain names, totally new IP addresses. And then when you get into the malware side of things or what they're doing on the endpoints, you can occasionally see reuse of full code bases. But again, that's getting less and less common. So you end up just finding maybe some reuse of little parts of a piece of code. You might see some tactics that look similar, like maybe the code is different, but once they get in, they kind of did the same sequence of thing once they landed. So there are things that investigators can look at in order to try to answer some of those questions, but they're all extraordinarily difficult to put a complete picture together. And you always have this problem of kind of a somebody looking at their argument from the kind of red teaming it, saying, hey, how might you be wrong? There's always ways you can throw darts at that because people can kind of copycat other previous attacks to try to look like somebody else. You could do an attack where you intentionally try to make it look like somebody else and get the finger pointed at the wrong person. So all of that becomes very difficult. It's a little bit error prone to come up with those type of conclusions.
Let's bring Andrew into the conversation. Andrew, I understand you are a former hacker.
That is correct.
Are you proud of that label?
I am. I am proud of that label. I mean, because on one hand, it says I can talk about some really cool stuff and I've had some really cool experiences. But on the other hand, I'm not as much kind of into the offense stuff before as I used to be. You know, when I say former hacker, the majority of it isn't really that I was breaking the law in a lot of the ways. It's mostly I was really deep in offense for paid customers that I was helping them find vulnerabilities in their own network. And that's largely where that kind of title comes from, if that makes sense.
Now, I understand that you got involved with this at a very young age, 17 years old. What brought you into this?
It was actually 13.
Oh, okay.
But what actually got me into this originally was I had a computer, I had a laptop, and I was really lucky to have this laptop. And then one day my hard drive stopped working. And I couldn't figure out why, and so I really wanted to use the computer. I wanted to talk to my friends. I wanted to play games. but I couldn't because my hard drive didn't work anymore. So I started viciously Googling around the internet to find a way to use a computer without a hard drive. And I happened onto this thing called a Linux forum, which is a different operating system. And these people basically were talking about how I could actually boot an operating system off of a CD instead of off of a hard drive. And so I installed Linux when I was about 13, which is a much more complicated operating system than Windows. Way more so even at the time. And I just started using that, and that was really the start for me to kind of get into computers and thus get into computer hacking.
Well, I'm getting the impression of someone young who is incredibly intelligent and very curious. And
yeah, I think you hit on the right word there. It really is all about curiosity. And hacking, you know, hacking to us isn't necessarily a pejorative term, and most people in the industry would say it's not about breaking the law. It's not about going into computer systems you're not authorized to go into. That's kind of what you often think of as hacking, but really it's more about curiosity, ripping things apart, and understanding how things work at a very low level. And Andrew brings that to the table, and just about any good security researcher out there, most of whom are doing a lot of good trying to make security better, they're very curious. They like to rip things apart. They understand how they work. And in the course of finding out how things really work at a low level, you figure out how to break them.
Andrew, going back to your early days in hacking and your computer work, you had mentioned that you had gone on to Google to look for ways of being able to operate your computer without a hard drive. Where did your education in learning the ins and outs of computers go from there?
I found that there's a really sharp learning curve to getting into hacking and getting into sort of cybersecurity, as we call it now. There's a sharp learning curve, especially at the time. There were no definitive resources to go to. It was kind of like it was all looked at as sort of black magic. So from there, it's just a lot of reading and a lot of kind of understanding how a lot of different things work. And over time, after reading technical specifications, documents, reading research papers, reading code, reading things like that, after doing that for a long time, spending a lot of hours doing that, things sort of start to click for you in a way that you kind of start to understand how everything works together. And that's really when it starts to come together, when you sort of start to realize how computers work, how security works, how people get access to things that they shouldn't have access to, how people make computers do things that they weren't originally intended to do, if that makes sense.
And Andrew, you were saying that you began with helping clients with their security issues. How did that start?
So that started where basically I actually dropped out of high school when I was 17. And so I knew that I wanted to do this kind of work, but I'm from Columbia, South Carolina, and there weren't really any hacker jobs at that time. And so I kind of just ended up sending my very short, almost non-existent security resume to like every security company that I could find under the sun, hoping that one of them would hire me. And most of them saw my resume and said, they didn't even call me back. Because they figured, I was 17, I didn't know what I was doing. And I was, meanwhile, just grinding away, still trying to learn as much as I possibly could. And eventually, a small security consulting company in Washington, D.C. called me back, brought me in for an interview, and gave me the job. And so, essentially, what my job actually became was I was something called a penetration tester or a security consultant. And companies, any range in like really, really, really large companies, all the way through, Fortune 500, as well as government organizations, universities, hospitals, were paying my company to actually come in and attack their network the same way that bad guys do. The only difference is at the end of it, we don't steal their data. We don't destroy anything. We write a very detailed report of exactly what we did and how we did it in order to gain access to the assets so they could go back and fix it. And I don't do that anymore, but that was basically a big part of kind of my experience of really getting to work on some of these big, large, complex networks and solve really hard problems and really, really get to think like an attacker and really do some really fun and exciting things.
Doing this kind of work sounds almost like you've got to be almost a good chess player to do this kind of work. You got to anticipate moves and provide a strategy and so forth.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. You really have to think about and have some experience understanding what the other side is likely to do, and then try to place yourself sort of in that pathway to observe that activity and know what to look for, and then make some educated, well, they're not so much guesses, but they're also not always very solid, yes, this is definitely bad, but sort of some good assumptions about what might be bad and kind of use your gut occasionally as a security researcher playing defense.
How real and how big is the cyber threat?
It's substantial and growing. It's a tool of governments now as cyber espionage is a big thing. It's becoming a tool. You know, I think we should all anticipate, and certainly the Department of Defense's Cyber Command, looking at both kind of offensive aspects of cyber for part of DoD planning and also defense being a huge issue where it could be a new tool of asymmetric warfare that people bring at us. So it's big for that. And it's also a hugely booming, really, industry for cyber criminals to make lots of money off of cyber attacks. We're seeing things like exponential rise in the number of ransomware infections hitting mm-hmm. people's computers and, you know, millions upon millions of dollars going into the pockets of criminals through these malicious activities that are affecting now not just companies, but individuals. So it is definitely a growing issue and it should concern all of us.
What are some of the cyber issues that you've dealt with in your career that you found to be the most challenging?
I'd actually say what we're doing right now is really fundamentally the most challenging, because previously I had worked on, you know, kind of specific, well-defined operational items within the U.S. Department of Defense. It's a sort of a known beginning and known end. And now coming to help build a product where I lead a team of researchers building ways to detect and prevent against hackers coming in. It's a very open-ended problem, and it's a constantly evolving adversary. It's not a static thing we're trying to target. We have to kind of be understanding what's happening now, but also be understanding how resilient our detections and prevention capabilities might be against what attackers are doing in a year. So it's very challenging, and we have to bring lots of different expertise against the problem. We're applying things like machine learning and artificial intelligence to this problem. We're taking people who have played offense like Andrew and bringing them in to help us defend against the threat. It's a very open, not well-defined space. So we're constantly faced with challenges and constantly trying to keep ahead of things.
Andrew, I'm curious, is there a growing community, especially young people, considered hackers?
The hacker community is very different from how it was 20 years ago, but there are certain fundamentals that are certainly still the same. And definitely, there are local chapters of hacker conferences now that people can go to kind of all over the world. So 15 years ago, it may be that there were 3 security conferences and you'd have to travel halfway across the world to get one. And that's just inaccessible for young people and for a lot of people. And now I think it's a lot more accessible with things like conferences and university chapters and things like that.
Now, we're talking about the good guys, though, right?
Well, we are talking about the good guys, but what you have to understand when you're talking about hacker culture is that at a certain point, whether you break into computer systems or defend computer systems is less defining. And what's more defining is your motivations and whether or not you're operating within the bounds of the law. For example, I always operated within the bounds of the law, and I was completely tearing computer networks apart for years. I was actually exercising tactics that would have been completely, blatantly, brutally illegal if I wasn't authorized to be doing them. So on one hand, I would be considered a bad guy, quote, professional bad guy, because I was breaking into computers and stealing stuff. But on the other hand, our customers were authorizing us to do everything, and we didn't actually end up causing any damage to the customer. It was all an exercise. We were all supposed to be doing everything that we were doing. We had all of our lawyers check off on everything to make sure we didn't go to jail or anything, and we would write reports, and ultimately, we were actually helping the security of our customers.
I wanted to touch upon this, and that was what's been making headlines in recent weeks, was the break-in into the Democratic National Committee, the Democratic Congressional Committee, and, of course, Hillary Clinton's campaign committee. A lot of people have been pointing fingers in different directions, specifically toward Russia. Mark, do you have any comments about what happened or how it happened or if Russia indeed is responsible or how do you know?
Sure. I think those are all pressing questions. And like I mentioned earlier, attribution is what we call, hey, was it the Russians or not, mm-hmm. is a very difficult question to answer properly. There's been some very good analysis on that from some companies who were on the ground doing remediation, responding, cleaning up, and doing some analysis. And they initially pointed the finger at some tradecraft and some files left behind on systems that had some hallmarks of some previous Russian attacks. That evidence, which is related to, you know, some of the domain registration, points at some ties. And there's some of the malware used points at some previous Russian capabilities. I won't say yes or no, it was them. What I'll say is that I looked at the evidence, we looked at it closely, and it's compelling their case that it could be Russia. There may be another explanation, but I wouldn't say that no way it definitely wasn't the Russians, because the evidence is consistent with some stuff that's likely past Russian activity.
Mark Dufresne, Andrew Morris, thank you, gentlemen, for joining us today.
All right, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
That was Mark Dufresne and Andrew Morris of Endgame Incorporated, an Arlington, Virginia-based cybersecurity firm that helps businesses to proactively go on offense and hunt for attackers on their networks. And I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Press Conference USA. I'd like to thank all of our guests for joining us for today's program. A big thank you also goes out to Anya Zalewski for her help in making arrangements for our guests to appear on today's program. This is Rick Pantaleo reminding you to join Carol Castiel next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.